They were terrible. I'm still one. I love it.
Honey, lad.
The sky's slamming again.
Who paid for the nachos?
Nor rain, nor wind, nor snow classico.
Boarding the high line with Rabbi in red. Talking the rabbits and turning heads. With questions from you and analysis. In your car, in your home. Thank you for tuning to Holding the High Line.
Hello, Rapids fans. This is Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. We are brought to you by Icarus SC and Roughneck Scarves. My name is Matt Pollard, and it is Thursday, August 11th, 2022. Jossie Zardes is rounding into form just in time for his first match against Columbus Crew since being traded to the Burgundy Boys. The Premier League is back, and most of the other European leagues are on their way this coming weekend, if they have not started already. And the Colorado Rapids are now just 3 points below the playoff line in the Major League Soccer Western Conference. I'm joined now by a man who is full of hummus and surrounded by chutzpah, Rabbi Mark Goodman.
Hey guys, how's it going? Matt is alluding to the fact that I am abroad. I am in Israel. It's been a really good trip, Matt. It's been a lot of fun. We're having a good time here. Mostly I'm just eating things nonstop. That's really the goal. Except we were here for a fast today, which is not ideal. You come to Israel, you come to eat, and on the second day you arrive, you literally can't eat or drink anything for 25 hours. It's super dumb. But hey, that's life.
That's tough coming out of international flight too, Rabbi. How was the jet lag? Obviously, we're recording this. I got early for us to record before I had to go to work. We didn't want to record before the All-Star game in case something dramatic happened in that as it related to a Columbus Crew player looking ahead to this game on Saturday. For the most part, Holding the High Line this year, folks, will be MLS All-Star game agnostic. If the MLS All-Star game refuses to acknowledge the existence of Diego Rubio or the Colorado Rapids in general, then we will refuse to ignore it and any of the sponsors that it comes from. That's the deal, Don Garber. You made your bed with this. So, Rabbi, we were waiting until that. We thought we might record on Wednesday night for me, Thursday morning for you. So it's now almost 6:45 a.m. on Thursday, August 11th, and I'm going to assume, Rabbi, it's almost dinner time for you. How's the jet lag and adjusting to that been, and have you done anything soccer-related?
So adjusting to jet lag, no big deal. It's a 9 hours difference, so it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon here, Matt. So it's 9 hours difference to Colorado and 7 hours to the United States. The kids bounced back pretty good. I mean, we did pretty good too. It just took a couple days. There were a couple nights in a row, like the second and the third night in a row, where like my daughter and I inexplicably woke up at like 1 o'clock in the morning and just couldn't get back to bed. And like one of those days we went back to bed at 6 a.m. and the other day we just got up, and that was that. And that's how we got. That's how you get over jet lag. When you just have one day where you're like, I'm going to tough it out. I'm going to keep going. Soccer related. Mostly I've been looking for soccer trinkets. I saw an Israel national jersey to buy the other day, but it was at the fancy schmancy store. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to go to the mall that I haven't been to in like 20 years. They have like a sporting goods store and they should have a couple of teams. But strangely enough, Israeli soccer team stuff is actually pretty hard to find. Generally, you get it at the stadium at the game, or you don't get it at all. There was one store in the kind of outdoor like market, which is called the Shuk, that used to have this kind of stuff. But I walked by it the other day, and I think the store was out of business. So I don't think – I may give it a go tomorrow morning if I'm really feeling adventurous. But we took the train, my daughter and I, yesterday up north. It was about a three-hour each way train trip to visit some folks that I teach online. And on the train, we passed by not one, not two, but three huge stadiums. The state of Israel has really done a good job of building a lot of cookie cutter stadiums at the second division. Imagine kind of like if the Houston Dynamo, FC Dallas, Colorado Rapids stamp. Those three stadiums are almost identical for anyone who's been to any of them. Imagine if a country used kind of state money and civic money to build 20 of those. So there are all these round, half-covered stadiums that seat about 11,000, or somewhere between 8 and 11,000. There's like 20 of them. We passed by the one for Netanya, the one for Akko, and we also passed by the stadium for one of the smaller teams in Tel Aviv. So, but the Israeli Premier League is a decent-sized league. I'd say the top teams are pretty good. Just yesterday, the champions from last year, Maccabi Haifa, qualified for the final round of the qualifying before the group stage of the UCL. So Haifa is going up against one of the scariest teams in all of Europe, and that is Partizan Belgrade. And they have to play a home-and-home series against them in order to qualify. Those matches in Israel are actually not nationally televised. The last round, which was, Apollonia Limassol, the champions of Crete, or Cyprus, I think, actually Cyprus. That match was only broadcast on YouTube TV. So if you have YouTube TV, you might be able to watch all of the Maccabi Haifa matches for this year. So that's pretty exciting. But otherwise, the Israeli Premier League kicks off this Saturday. Saturday night, in most of the cities, the games will not start until the Sabbath is over. So Shabbat comes in. Shabbat goes out at about 8:15. So the match day starts at 8:30. But that's only if your city has a significant number of religiously observant Jews. If you don't have religiously observant Jews, you can kick off an hour earlier at 7 o'clock. So the entire Israeli Premier League will kick off this Saturday. I don't think I can go to a match because my club that I really love is playing its first home match in Petah Tikva, which is about an hour and a half away, and we have to catch a plane the next day, so my in-laws will be nervous. So my plan is probably, if I'm up for it, to find out which bars in the nearby area will show Israeli soccer and go and hit match day number one here at the local pub.
It's interesting, Rabbi, what you said about merch in terms of you get it at the stadium, you get it at the game, or you don't get it at all. I was obviously, every single time that I've been abroad, I am, you know, constantly on the lookout for stuff and everything. And, you know, when I go with my parents or I go with other people, like I tell them, like, this is what I'm looking for. These are the colors that will be, or like the name that you're going to try and find if something close to English that we're looking for. And so I remember when my mom and my dad took a European river cruise, they came back after going to Belgrade and got me a Red Star Belgrade scarf mark. But I have to admit, it was I was searching for some diamonds in the rough last time I was in Europe in order to get the scarves that I got. The Fire Nord scarf, obviously, I got physically at the game, and then the Antwerp scarf that I got for myself and for you. I found at one decent store that had merch as well, and they had some old Belgium stuff as well because they were waiting for that stuff to get sold out before, in order to make room, obviously, for the new merch that was going to come later in the year for the World Cup. Obviously, you know, we're what, 4 months out from the World Cup, and we mostly don't have any of that going on. So
you can get Beitar Yerushalayim, Beitar Jerusalem stuff. I was just on the main drag in the shopping district to get new kippot, because you can't get decent kippot in Pittsburgh. So I bought two new kippot. I'm wearing one of them. It's a black one with a little fringe. Very exciting, because literally, I mean, think about it, folks. Like, I have to get on a plane and spend, like, the airfare to Israel is between $1,000 and $1,500. I have to spend $1,500 to get a decent kippah, right? Which is a thing I literally wear every single day of my life. The alternative is to have married a woman who knows how to knit, and I did not. So, or to teach myself to knit. But Beitar Jerusalem, in Maccabi Tel Aviv, you could probably get on the street in Tel Aviv anywhere, but we didn't spend any time in Tel Aviv. I went through Haifa, but didn't stop. I assume you could get Maccabi Haifa stuff anywhere. And by the way, Maccabi Haifa's goalkeeper is Josh Cohen, formerly of Sacramento Republic. So an American, a Jewish guy. So he's kind of like a it'll be a big deal if he makes it into the Champions League, especially if Arsenal isn't in the Champions League and they wind up starting Ethan Turner at some point this year. But anyhow, so the other club that you can get anywhere, of course, Barcelona and PSG. I saw a whole bunch of Barcelona and PSG merch all over already, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, you want other places that I've been in Europe, Mark, you know, you want Real Madrid, you want Barcelona or something, but getting something from a local club kind of depends on you being in the right spot or it being match day or you being around the stadium. You know, tourists going to, going to random place in Spain that is not Barcelona or Madrid looking for something other than the local team or Barcelona or Real Madrid, can be a little bit slim pickings. But Mark, you mentioned all the local pop-up stadiums. And speaking of pop-up, smaller, kind of basic stadiums, there's a new controversy that is occurring in our homeland, Mark, of Southern California, as the lease for Orange County SC of Dylan Powers, of defending USL champions of the USL Championship, are trying to renew their lease, and there was a bidding process in order to see who could occupy and, have a home at the Orange County Great Park at the Champions Soccer Stadium. And now there's a controversy as potentially LA Galaxy 2, who will be moving to USL Next Pro next season, are potentially also vying for it. Orange County SC tried to get out of this early with a club statement on the afternoon of August 8th, basically accusing LA Galaxy of trying to threaten lower division soccer, saying that it's not in line with what they have, implying that, this is MLS single entity as opposed to, the true and organic, the true soccer growth that is occurring in the USL. And then some pretty scathing banter here, Mark, basically saying, that the LA Galaxy are doing this amidst them losing out on the city of Los Angeles over the last 3 or 4 years. This team can't even make the playoffs, and they're trying to kick out a team, that has won the USL championship, that has grown its community in the Orange County area, as the LA Galaxy continue to try to affirm, even though they are in Carson, California, which is technically in Los Angeles County, that they are a Los Angeles team, despite having more of their fan base from the OC. The LA Galaxy came out with a statement later, basically within 30 minutes, saying, "The LA Galaxy are a proud partner of local soccer communities and are committed to the positive growth of the sport of soccer in Southern California. The LA Galaxy are not interested in an exclusive agreement for LA Galaxy 2 to play at the Orange County Great Park Championship Soccer Stadium and have advised all parties of our willingness to open up a conversation with the City of Irvine. City of Irvine owns the stadium and our stakeholders for a mutually agreeable arrangement pertaining to the use of the stadium moving forward." Mark, the LA Galaxy Galaxy 2 normally have played, if not physically at the main stadium at the Diggity, they have played at the Track and Field Stadium, which is not a very – it might actually be worse than the original home of the Switchbacks, folks. So, Mark, there's some he said, she said in terms of the actual details about the closed envelope bidding for it to the City of Irvine. There's some he said, she said in terms of are they bidding it for it being exclusive versus not. At the same time, Orange County SC are owned by a billionaire hedge funder who could have spent more money on that bid, knowing potentially that it wasn't just going to be him bidding for it. Mark, what do we make of this? How do we continue to exist given this might now be the front of the war between MLS Next Pro and the USL?
It's a great challenge. I mean, I think it's going to blow over right now, but one of the comments that I really liked, someone was making the argument that this is really one of those gut check moments. First of all, it's a shot fired in the soccer wars. It's basically there's been a very clear division between USL and MLS for the last couple of years. The two are not on the same page at all. They're not exactly competing because there are very few cities with both teams where they're competing in the same market for the same fans. But they're not cooperating at all. And I think LA is actually one of the rare places where they are competing effectively. They're not on the same page. And Orange County is drawing way more fans than LA Galaxy 2. So the idea that Orange County should be pushed out of their stadium so that the LA Galaxy could move in so that zero fans could attend those games was pretty bizarre. It seemed like on the face, like a challenge straight up to just try and eliminate this team. But the the flip side of that is USL teams need to grow up, right? All these owners are, they're not 100 millionaires or billionaires. They tend to be tens of millionaires. And what that means is if they want to exist in the future of soccer, they need to band together. A team ownership group needs to have, you know, in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and it needs to be able to buy its own stadium, right? The reason the Pittsburgh Riverhounds are stable and they no longer have to worry is that they own their stadium and they own the parking lot. And so they don't have to worry financially about whether they have to share or whether the city's going to run them out or whether the lease is going to come up or whether they're going to be profitable. They average about 4,000 fans a game. Parking is $15 a car. They sell out the parking lot and more. They're doing great on merch and they win every season, right? That's the model in USL. Do that for long enough, and maybe if you want, you might even be able to jump to MLS. But like the model of we're going to go down to the local, you know, community soccer park and rent the 2,000 seat stadium and hope the city gives us a waiver on alcohol sales and hope that the LA Galaxy, who also share that stadium, aren't going to take all the choice dates. Or we hope that playing at the local baseball field is going to be okay for us, even though the view lines are terrible and, you know, players have to run across turf that's been laid over the pitcher's mound, right? Like, those are secondary options. And if you indulge in them and you persist in them for too many years, on some level, you get what you pay for, right? You absolutely, you get what you deserve. You're asking for trouble. So I am actually, you know, a little bit tough here on OC that they need to grow up. They need to put some big boy pants on. And if they don't want to be bullied around by the big guys in soccer, they need to make smart moves.
Yeah, no, well said there, Mark. I think like this is the cautionary tale behind signing a short-term lease for ultimately a city-funded stadium. And this is the difference between doing private construction, as we've seen with some MLS stadia and other stadia around the world, where if you privately fund it, and understandably that's a big expense, and maybe you don't see that money for a while, or maybe that particular owner shells out a bunch of money and then doesn't get all of that money back in investment in terms of what becomes of the stadium and the revenue options and everything, that the benefit of that is you control everything in that regard. I was just looking it up, Mark, and if we're believing, you know, the Wikipedia page for Dick's Sporting Goods Park was that, you know, the club in the city announced a $130 million project, and that included the City of Commerce, Commerce City, and their voters agreeing to a bond for infrastructure improvement of $65 million. It's not clear to me when that's been paid back or anything, but the point is that Kroenke shelled out a bunch of money. They own the surrounding land and everything. Say what you will about him as an owner. Say what you will about how KSC operate the Colorado Rapids. They are first and foremost, or Kroenke is first and foremost, a real estate and a property guy, and so he knows that and made it such that the Colorado Rapids were going to get evicted because an entirely, you know, city or state funded stadium, and they only signed a short term lease thinking, oh, we might be bigger at this point, and then potentially getting pushed out, you know, by, you know, an NWSL women's team that is able to take it over because they do better than the Rapids on the field or in the stands. And so I think this is a cautionary tale for this. I think this is also just a further indication that any market where lower division is trying to compete with MLS, that the MLS team and market is going to have more pull financially, is going to have more pull potentially politically, and if there's an opportunity for them to flex their proverbial muscles in order to get a little bit more control or encroach on your territory in a way that benefits them in a certain way, that they're potentially going to take advantage of that. You know, Mark, when's the last time you heard anything about New York Cosmos? Not a whole lot. Why? Because there's two MLS teams in the greater New York area, and one of them's potentially building a stadium in Queens, the original home of the original home of the New York Cosmos, and is also impeding on the, I think there's a Queens USL team that's potentially coming as well. You know, Austin Boulder basically going the way of the Dodo because of Austin FC. The Silverbacks have not existed since Atlanta United have come into existence. Do I think that there are some markets big enough to have both an MLS team and various iterations of lower division teams, whether it's NISA, whether it's USL, an MLS Next Pro team affiliated or otherwise with that MLS team? Yes, but that requires on cooperation. And the simple fact is, in any of those markets, big or small, the MLS team is going to be the big fish. I hope this doesn't lead to Orange County becoming USL Wanderer, becoming Orange County Wanderers or anything. They are a good team. They are a good franchise. They are a net benefit to Orange County and to the USL Championship and everything. I would not be opposed to there being some sort of shared agreement where those two teams use a good quality lower division soccer-specific stadium rather than one of them having to be at the track and field stadium at Dignity Health Sports Park. But, you know, this is going to require some coordination, and clearly if the LA Galaxy have the ability to flex their muscles for the benefit of their MLS Next Pro team and Orange County isn't able to or willing to do that, then that's going to be a problem. So I don't think the Rapids are encroaching on Hailstorm or on Colorado Springs Switchbacks anytime soon, but this is a cautionary tale, I think, for any MLS, any lower division team that is within 30 to 50 miles of a MLS stadium. Listeners, this past Saturday at Dick's Sporting Goods Park, the Colorado Rapids got their 6-point week completed with a 4-3 victory over the hapless and undermanned Minnesota United. Abu Dhanladi gets the scoring started in the 4th minute to make it 1-0 off of a corner. Franco Fragapane with a great flick down header to bounce the ball off the turf, and then Dhanladi finishing with a nice little side jump volley. A little bit of martial arts there, folks. Keegan Rosenberry slow to react to Fragapane at the near post, and then Gustavo Villasia certainly undone at the back post by Abu Dhanladi. Jossi Zardes gets his first of 3 goals to tie it 3 minutes later off of a rebound from Diego Rubio. Great passing up the middle from some direct play from the Colorado Rapids to set up Rubio for the open shot. And then Dane St. Clair, who had a fantastic game the other night, Mark, in the All-Star game, bumbles his way and then allows Jossi Zardes to have a nice little tap-in. Very similar sequence to an opportunity Zardes would have had in the Rocky Mountain Cup, what, maybe a month ago now. And Jossi Zardes finished this unlike he did against Zach McMath. 11th minute, it becomes 2-1. Diego Rubio with a thumping header off of a long throw from Keegan Rosenberry that was effectively a corner that caught the Loons napping. 3 defenders in the area as well as the goalkeeper. Brent Coleman ducks at the last end. Maybe somebody communicated to him, Mark, that somebody else had it and therefore he should duck. And maybe that person was Diego Rubio. I don't know. 15th minute, it becomes 3-1. Keegan Rosenberry with another quick throw in it to Michael Barrios, springing a counterattack. Barrios squares the ball through defenders to Jossi Zardes, who beats Dane St. Clair 1v1 to make it 3-1. And then 2 minutes before halftime, Benitez with a nice little move inside the box to find Amaria in space, who does a nice little, I don't know if it was officially a Cruyff turn, but he had his back to goal. He makes a nice turn to kind of face the front of goal and then shoot across goal, hit the inside side netting. Estevez was nutmegged by Benitez on the sequence. Danny Wilson maybe gave Amaria a little bit too much space. Really the only time that Amaria the whole night had enough space in order to make a move, think, and then finish in tight quarters. Dane St. Clair is great to start off the second half, but Mark, that was, of course, after a weather delay that came midway through halftime, and halftime in total, if you're talking about end of the first half to start of the second half, total almost 1 hour and 45 minutes, one of the longer continuous rain delays, weather delays that we have seen at Dick's Sporting Goods Park. That also prompted a scheduled halftime sub, folks, with Jack Price coming out. No extended calf injury whatsoever. Robin Fraser said after the game he wanted to make sure that the time that Jack Price had been out since June 19th, I believe, was the last time that he was going to be out. So in comes Felipe Gutierrez, who had just signed with the team and I thought had a fantastic debut in the second half. 61st minute, Jossi Zardes makes it 4-2. Very similar sequence to the Rapids' first goal. Diego Rubio with a shot outside the box. Dane St. Clair doesn't gather the rebound. Zardes makes the a preemptive run and then ultimately has a tap-in with the keeper right there. 81st minute, Brent Coleman makes it 4-3, the final scoreline, with a header at the back post. Danny Wilson in a position to defend him there. Some poor set piece defending from the Rapids on the whole of last week, folks. And then finally, a spectacular save on a breakaway by William Yarbrough on Hulongwane, Hulongwane, on the last name. Rapids get out of Dodge 4-3. Rabbi, what was your good thing from this past Saturday's victory over the Deathloons?
Because I was in Israel, that match came on at 4 o'clock in the morning for me, and so I did not watch it. So all I got to see was, and all you can pick up on MLS is highlights, and basically all the highlights because of all the scoring was goals. So, I mean, Jossie Zarda's hat trick is got to be it. I think, you know, we stopped talking about the Jossie Zarda's DEFCON chart effectively, and now I think the reason for that is it is pretty much gone. Like, we don't have to, we're not really worried about whether Jossie Zarda's can score anymore, and we're also starting to potentially move into the world where we are eating some crow over Diego Rubio, like where we basically have to acknowledge that, like, you know, Joe Samuelson, our friend and fellow writer podcaster, posted today that his goals added is third amongst all MLS strikers, and basically everybody else on the list is at the All-Star game, which we will proceed to not talk about. But like, you know, we were saying a couple months ago, gee, I don't know. I don't think Jossie Zardes and Diego Rubio complement each other. And also, neither of them has been very productive. And therefore, this seems like a bust. We were trying to fix the wrong pieces. Or Porik, you know, he shot a shot. You know, he basically said, Jossie Zardes is the guy we should go out and get. By the way, I said we should go out and get Jossie Zardes. And then I said we should be patient. And then I started to think to myself, like, I think we're done here. I think the Jossie Zardes experiment has failed. And no sooner did I say that, the Jossie Zardes experiment seems to be succeeding. And Diego Rubio seems to be a productive kind of recessed number nine, shoulder running, you know, twin striker. Matt Doyle also had some really interesting points in the in his piece this week, which I highly recommend. He made a really good point, which I don't know if I agree with. But I think it's worth, because I think Matt was looking at it the wrong way. Matt was looking at the new formations that Robert Frazier has dropped, which is he's effectively gone 4-4-2, 4-1-4-1, or 4-3-3, depending on how you look at it or depending on, you know, who's on the field at any given time, and effectively dropped the 3-5-2 attack. And Matt Doyle's take on that was basically, oh, you know, this is functional and this is strategic. And my take has been get the best 11 guys on the field. And our best 11 guys has not included three center backs. We don't have three center backs who are as good as, you know, enough to rate that they'd get themselves onto the field in any situation. So if you're getting your best 11 on the field, then it means four at the back. So I think those are a few of the takeaways that I had from this match, which is that the Rapids have turned a corner with both of their strikers. They've turned a corner with their positioning. They seem to be on the upswing, and they're scoring. They're getting points. You know, I mean, they really need to get all the points at home because their road form has been so shaky for the rest of the way in order to make the playoffs. And so far, they are getting all their home points. They're even getting road points, as we saw the other day. So, a big thing or a good thing from this match is that we are really turned around and we're doing really well. Matt, what from a seasoned veteran who was in the catbird seat watching all the events, even after the rain delay, what was your takeaway from this match?
Yeah, no, one of the benefits of being in the press box, folks, despite it being a mostly outdoor press box, there's some seating at like the top level right before the windowed glass to ultimately go outside that usually the photographers take over. For an outdoor press box, we are relatively well protected from the elements. I have been to pretty much every single home game from the press box since the start of the 2016 season. I can't recall a game where we were rained on, where we actually had precipitation on our countertop or the seats that we had. We're pretty well protected by the roof that extends out a good, I'd say at least 15 to 20 feet above and beyond where we are there. The only time we really have weather is when there's a lot of wet, heavy, but slow-moving, fluffy snow, and then there's a little bit of a wind draft, in which case then we can get snow in our faces. But Mark, as you can attest to, usually when there is a snow classico, I am the only person who has electronics out because I'm a crazy person, and I like to tweet through snow classicos regardless of what's going on with my frostbite, and everybody else is just kind of like, okay, I'll write after the game, and I'm not using my phone until it's time to record stuff post-game. But so, you know, I thought Felipe Gutierrez was absolutely fantastic. I wasn't really sure what to expect from him. Obviously, you and I, Mark, were a little bit not skeptical of the player, but just disappointed that that was the only move that the Rapids made after Marc-Anthony Kay, and that ultimately this was putting a Band-Aid over a long-term problem with no option to buy. I'm not sure that Felipe Gutierrez is coming back to MLS or coming back to the Colorado Rapids long-term. And so then ultimately it was, well, this is, you know, we're bringing in one guy to plug a gap right now, and maybe we've made certain promises to him financially. Maybe he just really wants to hang out with Diego Rubio on his off days. Maybe they're guaranteeing him playing time in ways that he was not getting at his club team back in South America. And so, you know, I was kind of wondering what were we going to see from him. And I thought he came in, he was immediately a gamer. I was really impressed with what he did defensively too. For as much as Sporting Kansas City Twitter, you know, praised what he had done on the ball from a goal scoring standpoint, from a number 10 standpoint, you know, he comes in, he puts in the defensive work rate, and really at times, not many opportunities, but several sequences where Minnesota had Colorado under the cosh, and ultimately there was an opportunity for him to make a play with the ball coming to him, how quickly he took a defensive action, and then every single person I spoke to post-game, Jossi Zardes, Diego Rubio, Robin Fraser, all said unprompted and without describing specifically what I'm about to tell you, all said the exact same thing. The ball comes to him, the game slows down, he's calm, there's absolutely no panic, he's aware situationally and spatially with what's around him, he makes a really quick and decisive move and then gets out of pressure. This is a guy who on the ball, two Loons defenders on him, he was gonna clown them. And so I thought that was really critical in several moments. I didn't necessarily see what I wanted to see from him offensively, but obviously at that point the Rapids had already scored three goals, and I'm wondering what his role is going to be going forward in a midfield where, you know, Mark, we pretty much, you know, in the absence of any other signings and Price not being fully healthy and some of the other options that the teams had off the bench, Diego Rubio is the number 10 on this team. He's effectively an underneath false striker from a midfield role. We saw that in terms of how he's gone forward and try and shoot. We saw it against Red Bulls. We've seen it against Portland. We saw him effectively get two assists to Jossi Zardes in this one. And so is Gutierrez going to be a little bit more of an 8? And that defensive work rate, I think, is something he's certainly physically capable of. I'm not sure that it's obvious to me that he did that in Sporting Kansas City. And so maybe Robin Treasure has found another really creative way to find a player with a certain set of skills, play them slightly out of position, and then have it work out spectacularly. I want to mention the Colorado Rapids punishing the mistakes of the opponent. This is the second game in which they did that really, really well. Where previously, Mark, in the season, we would have seen the Rapids have a very, very high XG. The opponents make mistakes. The Rapids get really, really good high-quality opportunities. Keeper makes a really great save. They don't end up finishing the opportunities. The opponent finishes those opportunities as well. I would say the opponents in the last two games also finished their opportunities, and this could have gone really, really close to, we're like two plays away, folks, from it being 2 points instead of 6 points last week. We're like three or four plays away from it being two losses. So, you know, we have to take that certainly in context. And then the last thing that I want to say, Mark, is the long throws component. I asked Robin Fraser about that. Two long throws from Keegan Rosenberry. To my knowledge, Mark, the Rapids do not have a throw-ins specialist on their coaching staff, unlike Liverpool FC. But I asked him about it. You know, was this just two moments of Keegan Rosenberry recognizing it? Or is this a indication that they've worked on this systematically and this is now a part of their offense and potentially a new set piece they take advantage of? And Robin Fraser went full coach speak, Mark. My Robin Fraser's not telling me everything meter was certainly going off haywire when he said this. He mentioned, you know, Chris Sharpie is at time, you know, one of the best set piece, you know, special teams coaches that exists in the league. And he's going to, so this is the exact quote, he's going to use all the resources available to him, and he should. So if we find a new way to score goals from set pieces, okay. And then he said, the next thing I would have said probably would have gotten me – probably would have not gone over too well. If I'm reading between the lines, Mark, this is totally a thing that the Rapids are doing. They've looked at this, whether it's specific to Minnesota. I'm not entirely sure. I'm now officially going to call, Mark, a throw-in in which Keegan Rosenberry throws it in from the sidelines and it travels at least 15 yards before coming down or a Rapids player possessing it. I'm officially calling that a set piece. Say what you will, folks. The Rapids, for me, are officially long throws FC. Rabbi, bad things.
Bad thing? I don't really know that there was one. I mean, I think what you said about the good thing was could be interpreted not as a bad thing, but like, so another Matt Doyle thing that came out of him. So now I've spared you the need to read his article, but he didn't spend a lot of time focusing on what the Rapids did right, but more so what's wrong with Minnesota. But one of the things that he said that was wrong with Minnesota is Dane St. Clair. And St. Clair spilled two balls, both of which were converted for goals, which points out that the Rapids are capitalizing on other teams' mistakes. You could make an argument in this match that the Rapids won because Minnesota were bad, not because Colorado was exceptionally good. Now, that's nitpicking. And I think that, folks like Jack Price, who I spoke with a couple weeks ago, there's a really good interview that I did with him. First part, I'm going to work on editing the second part of the video, the interview later today and hopefully post it. But like, Jack Price has talked a lot about the team just being unlucky and that the guys have what they need to kind of turn around and get wins. Luck works both ways, right? And so we had to be a little bit lucky in order to win this game. Very few goalkeepers are going to spill two goals. It's great that we converted both of them, but we've got to make sure to win games without needing the other team to look like the Keystone Cops. Matt, any bad things from you?
Yeah, I still think there's a lot of defensive faults. So to your point, Mark, I think in reality, if Dane St. Clair played up to how he's been this season as an MLS All-Star, Jossie Zardes should have only had one goal in this game. And the last two games, really, Rapids scoring 9 goals total, 5 against Red Bulls to win 5-4, 4 in this game to beat Minnesota 4-3, were them capitalizing on mistakes that you can't necessarily count on other teams making in this one. If we're talking about, somehow getting into the playoffs as the 7th seed, and then having to play in Austin or an LAFC at home, you can't count on 3 or 4 howlers from the opponent and then hope that you convert 2 or 3 of those 3 or 4 in order to really help you get into the game offensively. So it was good to see the Rapids punish the opponents. I could see where it's a really easy to make an argument that you can't rely, that's not a reliable source of your offense. And this is still a team that when the opponent has numbers behind the ball and is organized and they're not crisp and effective in their passing, has struggled this season against good teams, against bad teams, against bunkering teams, against counterattacking teams to create offense and open them up without also exposing themselves as well. And so where I think, Mark, there's maybe a little bit of fool's gold in this past week is, they played New York Red Bulls, who had to move their game to Tuesday because of the friendly they had over that weekend against Barcelona. On that day, they were playing their 4th game in 10 days. Any MLS team, even with squad rotation, with Open Cup, playing the kids, effectively having Red Bulls 2 versus FC Barcelona was going to be shot. If you're talking about 3 games in 10 days, like, that's a scheduled loss, even if it's a home game for the most part. And then, it should be pointed out that Minnesota struggled to create offense outside of Rapids' mistakes, with the exception of that second goal by Amaria, and they did so without Emmanuel Reynoso, who's their MVP, Robin Lund, who I would argue at worst is their third most important attacking player. I would say he can be as good as Fragapane. I think he's certainly more effective than Amaria, and he plays it on a bunch of different roles. So if you're talking about a player who can disorganize the Rapids defense by, being very fluid, almost total football up front in that front four, that was something that made the Rapids' life a little bit easier. I hesitate to say that the absence of Michael Boxall was super critical, because I thought Brett Coleman overall had an okay game. Obviously, you could argue he had a fault on the Diego Rubio goal, because if he doesn't duck, he probably gets his head to that, and Rubio doesn't score that thumping header at the near post. At the same time, he also scored on a header as well. So I And Michael Boxall had done all of those things, I wouldn't have been singling out Michael Boxall as saying, oh, Michael Boxall's a backup center back, and that made it easier for the Colorado Rapids. But, you know, the two wins the Rapids had were against a team that had absolutely no legs after the 60th minute. That made it easier for them to finish them off. And Minnesota was missing their two of their three most important attacking players in a game that ultimately proved to be a shootout. And all this is in the context of, I don't think Danny Wilson defensively on set pieces had a great 180 minutes last week, and this team continues to make mistakes to give their opponents options. The difference from those two games relative to games that we've seen earlier in the season is that the Rapids would get those same opportunities off of mistakes from the opponent and would not finish those. So this is a good sign in terms of what the team's doing offensively. Jossie Zardes is rounding into form. There's confidence in everything. And so potentially the results lead to more belief, which lead to greater effort, which then back up those results in the long term. Those lead to further confidence, which I think helps the team believe that they can get results against these good teams. And like I mentioned last week, maybe this perception, even if it's not reality, ultimately manifests reality. And so maybe right now, if the Rapids are going to make the playoffs, Mark, if this is going to be the start of a big long run, maybe this is them faking it until they make it in terms of the 4-point week against Orlando and the LA Galaxy, the 6-point week that they had last week. They improve some performances, tweak a few things, they increase by 10%, Lalas Abubakar comes back, he's better. If the defense figures things out and everything and all that happens and the offense continues to be really good, this can be a really, really good team. But there are still underlying issues, and there are certainly things that give me cause to pause about saying that the Rapids are back or that it's back on, given the state of the opponents from last week. In that regard, I agree with Matt Doyle that you could dissect Saturday's game more about what was wrong with Minnesota, what was missing from Minnesota, rather than what Jossie Zardes and the Rapids did well. Any big things from you, Rabbi, or shall we move on?
Well, it's all about sustainability. I mean, I really think the team could be said to have turned a corner. This might be the beginning of something big. They may charge to a final spot in the playoffs, and that would be a big deal. But it's not guaranteed. You know, it's a couple good results could just be bucking the trend and regressing to the mean in the opposite direction. They've been unfortunate. They've lost a few games where they should have won, but they scored below their expected goals. Now they're scoring above their expected goals, right? If they go back to kind of producing at average rate, we may be in trouble. And we also are facing some tough teams coming up, so we'll see. It's really hard to be as wishy-washy as I am and be someone who you Highline fans should listen to, but like, it really feels like rather than saying like categorically the Rapids have turned a corner, the Rapids have certainly turned a corner. Whether that corner is going to lead to the finish line or is going to lead to a series of other corners turned to regress right back to the spot that they're in, time will tell.
So we've got an Ask HDHL, Mark, that's going to lead to me breaking down some XG numbers. There was an original tweet on the weekend by Jordy Collins, and then it was quote tweeted by the notorious Burgundy Beard on Twitter with the Ask HDHL. So Burgundy Beard says, this would be a good hashtag Ask HDHL. Can we get a performance review of our keeper? We might be sleeping on him at Rapids 96 Podcast. The original quote's a photo of William Yarbrough celebrating. He's collected the ball. I think that's Abu Dunlady. It might be Kamar Lawrence in the background as well. I'm not sure about the context. I think this photo's from the second half. In any case, without Yarbrough's kick save in a 1v1 situation, this game ends 4-4. Hashtag Colorado versus Minnesota. Hashtag Rapids 96. So, Burgundy Beard and Jordy Collins, if we look at the overall XG for this game, the Rapids had an expected goals of 3.2. Minnesota had an expected goals of 1.4. If you're looking at the individual moments that ultimately should not have been goals, you would look at the third goal for Jossie Zardes had a lower XG of about one quarter, and then the Brett Coleman chance also had about a 23% chance of going in. Those are both, as an individual moment, a relatively high XG for a single opportunity, but all of those come in the context of kind of a sequence where one team had been dominating, but maybe not created enough chances to ultimately have one expected goal. The other goals, for the most part, were relatively high percentage chance. Abu Dunlady, 60%. The first Jossie Zardes goal had a 75% chance of going in. That's a effectively a penalty from an opportunity. And then the first goal for Giassi Zardes also had about a 50-50 chance of going in. The chance for Hulongwe, still not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, folks, had an XG of 0.08, so less than a 1% chance of going in. You would look at a breakaway and think, oh, a breakaway has a better opportunity, but you look at it on the actual sequence. William Yarbrough comes off his line. By the time the ball is shot from its location, Yarbrough is right in front of it. It's effectively a bang-bang save, and there's also two defenders in closing on it. So how do you get the ball around the keeper in that? Relatively low percentage chance of that coming off, but that's dependent upon the defenders closing down on the player and William Yarbrough being a very alert goalkeeper. I think Yarbrough, from a stat standpoint, has certainly been to a disadvantage recently with the Colorado Rapids. I wouldn't say any one of the four goals that he gave up at Red Bull Arena were his fault or where he was even most at fault. I thought he had a good game for a goalkeeper that ultimately had four goals against, and he thought he had several very good moments in this game despite giving up three goals on what should have been one and a half, so we'll figure one or two goals ultimately conceded. The goals that he's conceded are spectacular goals scored by the opponent, where the reason why they were able to score those were mostly faults of the defense in front of him. I think Yarbrough's had a good season, despite what I've said about Keegan Rosenberry not always being good defensively. Danny Wilson, who I didn't think was particularly good defensively in those two games. You had Lucas Estevez, who was nutmegged on one of the plays that I think led to the second Minnesota goal. So William Yarbrough was doing a lot with the defense in front of him. He certainly made a spectacular save in each of the game's last 2 weeks in order for the Rapids to get those two wins. And I don't believe that we should sleep on him. And anytime you ask Robin Fraser about William Yarbrough, even in games where he concedes multiple goals, he is quick to point out that that is not his fault. And he is a big reason for why this team has been successful. And he will need to be a big reason for this team to be successful if they want to make the playoffs this year. Listeners, this coming Saturday at Dick's Sporting Goods Park, the Colorado Rapids will be playing their first and only game of the season against Columbus Crew, and I believe their first game against the Crew since the start of the pandemic. The Rapids currently find themselves 10th in the Western Conference, just 3 points out of the playoffs. They have 30 points off of 23 games played, a record of 8 wins, 9 losses, and 6 draws, a goal difference of -2, and at DSG this season, their record has now improved to 7-2-3. Columbus Crew come in 5th in the Eastern Conference, 33 points off of 23 games played, a record of 8-6-9, a goal difference of +5, and away from their new stadium, they are 3-2-6. Mark, this is a team that was kind of struggling in the middle of the season, as Giassi Zardes will attest to. This is a team that has come on strong in the last month and a half of the season with the arrival of Cucho Hernandez, who has been absolutely spectacular for him. He and Lucas Elarayan have been a great 1-2 punch as the number 9 and the number 10. They obviously have Darlington Yagbi, who's still one of, if not the best American number 8 in Major League Soccer. Jonathan Mensah at the center back role and Eloy Room head up the defense, which has been a little bit leaky. I think that is certainly affected by the fact that they've had to rotate out the center back position. They've had some injuries. Obviously, they no longer have Abubakar Keita, who is now injured with the Colorado Rapids. This is a team that is still leaky defensively. This is a team that was looking for a source of offense attacking-wise. Luis Diaz has been a little bit inconsistent. So too has, who's the Portuguese guy that they have whose name I can never remember?
Pedro Santos?
Yes, Pedro Santos. Thank you, Mark. I think he's Portuguese.
Really?
They've had some issues with that, Rabbi, but they have a number 9 who's in form. He's scoring on set pieces despite being new to Major League Soccer. This is literally a very good plug-and-play. In that regard, Mark, I will say that Columbus Crew was maybe now in the long run, everybody other than Miguel Berry and maybe Caleb Porter's PR and branding ultimately won this trade out, because basically the excuse that they had was that Giassi Zardes was slightly underperforming, no longer worth his salary. They already had 3 DPs on the roster with him. Nagbi, I think, is one of them. Maybe it's Pedro Santos that's the other, and then obviously Lucas Elarayan. Basically, the complaint that they had was, you're not a guy that we could drop $4 million on, pay $3 to $4 million a year, and have them be an absolutely spectacular foreign DP signing. That is ultimately ultimately the complaint that they had about him. If we have the opportunity to move you within the league to then sign that player, we should, because with the new stadium and the new ownership, we now have the financial might to do so. So basically the complaint is, would be similar if the Colorado Rapids said, Diego Rubio, you're great. You're a great individual player. You are a great player from the Colorado Rapids. We're going to sell you for like $1.5 million in game, and then bring a great DP who's taking a step down to come to Major League Soccer, who's going to boss it like Carlos Heel. So basically that's the situation here, is that we're saying, Rubio, you're great. You're not Carlos Heel. We're going to sign an MLS MVP caliber foreign designated player. Giassi's artist, you're great. You've done a bunch of great things for the Colorado Rapids. You are not Josef Martinez. We're going to go out and we're going to sign our equivalent of Josef Martinez. I don't know that you can really – I don't know that you can fault them for doing that now that it's worked out in the long run. I should point out, Mark, that Giassi's artist in his last game scored more goals than Miguel Berry has scored in league play all season. Miguel Berry has just two, and what was it? When was he traded? He was traded on July 20th to DC United. Columbus Crew got 225K. in general allocation money, and then there's some performance incentives up to 100K in that. So the ceiling for them getting their money back on Miguel Berry to DC United, who are not a good soccer team right now, folks, is 325K, just 25 grand more than the floor of what they sold Giassi's artist for. So in terms of Caleb Porter's comments about Giassi, you know, basically saying that Giassi's artist is washed, we don't think he can be a goal scorer or anything, we're going with this young guy who scored like 2 goals for me at the end of last season, I believe he should start. He's our new future. Like, 3 months later, they traded him for less than the Rapids are ultimately going to get for Andre Shinyashiki, and he's not even going to be a starter at DC United. Was on some level an acknowledgement. Zardes was great. He just wasn't amazing. We're going to sign Cucho Hernandez. It's amazing. But, Mark, let's start from the top. Your thoughts on Columbus Crew, their recent form to get back into the playoff run. What is Cucho doing well? What is Lucas Zelarayán doing well? What do we see in this team and the problems that they pose, given that Zelarayán and Nagbe did have to play midweek in Minnesota?
Yeah. So some comments have been made about the Zelarayán and Cucho Hernandez connection being like the new Lucha Rue, that it's this really wonderful, exceptional thing. And I think that that's absolutely true, that those two are really powering the team right now. I'll just give you throw some numbers. I have not nerded out on American soccer analysis tables recently, so I'll throw it out at you. Cucho Hernandez has 0.24 goals added per 96 minutes. And the reason that I normalize that by per 96 is because he's only played 445 minutes. So if you compare him on the raw, he looks like a fairly above average MLS player. If you compare him based on, you know, minutes played, he's one of the best players in the league right now. He's just coming in real hot and doing exceptional things. Overwhelmingly, it's his passing, receiving, and shooting, which are the stats that blow things up and are really impressive. There's two other players to kind of note here. One you've already mentioned, and the other is just someone who's a name from the distant past that nobody really talks about anymore, and that's Darlington Nagbe. Darlington Nagbe leads all the players on both teams in minutes played with 2,246. Nagbe is basically... if you looked up in the dictionary, the prototypical box-to-box, both-way midfielder, that's who he is. But in addition to that, if you looked at his expected goals added, or not his expected goals added, his goals added number, he is a 0.00. And across each one of the discrete statistics that makes up that, dribbling, passing, shooting, interrupting, etc., it's all basically, he's either 0.01, 0.02, or minus 0.01 or 0.02. The dude is very consistently average at everything he does. It's a very solid player, but he's not exceptional. And I think that that's a thing to kind of think about, which is like, it's really great to have a player who's you can put out on the field and is going to give you rock solid production game in, game out. He's going to split lines. He's going to hold the ball very well, but he's not going to dribble at you. He's not going to score kind of ridiculous highlight goals. He's not going to backheel it for a perfect assist, right? Like, so he's just Mr. Consistency. Like, he's the midfield metronome par excellence. And I think that's worthy of note, but I also think what you have to think about when you think larger about what that means is Darlington Nagbe is a former U.S. men's national team player. He used to be the straw that stirs the drink for this team. He is not anymore. I mean, this is basically like talking about Michael Bradley if we weren't talking crap about Michael Bradley. Because what we do in general these days when we talk about Michael Bradley is, hey, remember when he was awesome? Now he's garbage, right? And Darlington Nagbe is kind of the opposite of that story, which is, hey, remember when he was awesome and he was all we talked about? Now he's very consistent, right? He's very reliable, but, you know, if you need him to lift you up, you're in trouble. And the last player I'll just mention is just to throw the numbers at you of the other player that you mentioned, because he is at the absolute bottom of this table. Miguel Berry has 1,044 minutes. He has a minus 11 in dribbling, which is and that's normalized per 96. He is worse than every other player on both the Rapids and on Columbus. And I would bet if you looked up strikers league-wide, he'd be in the bottom five of all strikers in MLS, right? So, which basically means, you know, the eye test on Miguel Berry is overwhelmingly, if you watched all of his possessions and all of his dribbles, what you'd see more than any other player is a man dispossessed, right? Sometimes in sports, someone says, he's a man possessed! If I was going to write an article about Miguel Berry, it would be, he's a man dispossessed, right? He dribbles at you, he turns it over. And that's what he's good at. I just want to throw out a couple other things. There's a few other players on this team that, you know, should have been more productive but aren't. Kevin Molino, the hot boy himself, is still a member of the Columbus Crew, but has been injured all year and has been out. A couple other players who are notable and worthy of mention. Marlon Hairston, former Colorado Rapid wide player, wonderful guy. He's only played about 159 minutes for Columbus this year. Unlikely to see him. Last thing I'll say, Matt, is this. This game is definitely the Jossy Zardes revenge match. This is where Jossy Zardes goes ham because he is angry at Caleb Porter and just decides to like flame him up and cause problems. So we'll see how it goes. It should be a lot of fun. The other reunion that we're going to be having is Jonathan Mensah and his boy.
Lala Sabubakar.
So two Guyanan players who also were both together on the back line for Columbus. I would bet that they're going to go out for Jollof Rice when the game is over and maybe, you know, a couple of beers and talk about old times. So that's really good. One last mention, I can't stop. Derek Etienne, formerly of NYRB, is having a pretty good season for Columbus, 1,696 minutes. He's been fairly productive. Watch out for him. He's a wide midfielder who can play very forward and can kind of throw in that ball. He's kind of the poor man's Thierry Henry, if you will. He comes from those wide Man City locations and tosses in balls. He can also be a late arriver a la Cole Bassett and kind of like suck those balls into the back of the net. So a lot of fun things on this team. I like watching them, but there are a lot of pieces that don't all kind of formulate together neatly into something that's consistently working on a regular basis.
Yeah, no. So, Mark, I'm going to take a slightly different spin on the narrative we're putting around this game about the Jossy. This is absolutely Jossy Zardes' first game against Columbus Crew. I don't know that it's a revenge game or a revenge tour for the reason I'm going to get to first, but I'll prompt this response from the Ask HTHL we got from Rapids 4 and Legion. Do you believe that Caleb Porter's comments regarding Jossy Zardes will have any bearing on Saturday's match against Columbus Crew? And while still early, assess the Zardes trade both for the Rapids and for Columbus Crew. As I mentioned earlier, Rapids 4 and Legion, I think ultimately how Columbus handled things post the trade, it was ultimately the right move. I think certainly Columbus lost it from the standpoint of we're going to get rid of Zardes and then get on the Miguel Berry hype train. They've proceeded to sell that for rock bottom price to DC United. But then obviously they've gotten Cucho Hernandez. So they've made an upgrade in terms of sending out one DP, getting a good valuation in terms of if that trade ends up blowing up in their face in terms of Zardes going off with the Colorado Rapids, they'll be compensated accordingly, more than $1 million in total assets there. And obviously they brought in a player who's scoring a bunch of goals, which Jossy Zardes was not doing with Columbus. So, I think that's good from a standpoint of Zardes wasn't a bad player. It just wasn't a healthy relationship. And so ultimately now Caleb Porter has found an actual good girlfriend that kind of meshes with him from a puzzle piece standpoint. And at the same time, I think Zardes has found that as well. But so Zardes was asked about this mark, kind of about how he was going to handle the Columbus game, and he said that he was going to treat it like every other opponent that has come into the stadium. It's an important, you know, to focus on the week, watching film with the coaching staff, and then my attacking watching with my attacking coaches and trying to find ways to exploit their particular team. Obviously, a defense that he's very familiar with, Jonathan Mensah, Eloy Room, were both there with him in Columbus, and you know, I treat it like any other opponent. You've got to leave the emotions and everything else out, because if you do, then that is going to control you, and you can't let that happen. And that's at the game, when the game starts, we just want to try and win 3 points. You know, Mark, I've asked him about this. I've asked him about a few other uncomfortable things. You know, we had the interview with him that I featured on this podcast, asking about his relationship with Caleb Porter, and rather focused on how things ended. He said, you know what, he was a coach who gave me a chance, helped me score a bunch of goals, almost win the Golden Boot, and ultimately he was the head coach that helped me start in and help lead a team to an MLS Cup final and to winning MLS Cup, and I will always be grateful for that. And so I think that Giassi Zardes has been extremely stoic throughout his life and throughout his career, despite two really uncomfortable exits from clubs that ultimately he was comfortable at and he was really happy at and ultimately he loved. You know, so if I'm pulling up, I think I still have this tagged on my Twitter. I posted this mostly to get clout with LA Galaxy Twitter.
Nice.
So I asked him after the game against the LA Galaxy, scored against his former team, about what emotions come up. Bearing in mind, folks, that ultimately his departure from the LA Galaxy was being played at outside back by Siggy Smit, being just relented for the fact that he couldn't solve the scoring woes of the LA Galaxy. Him being injured and basically saying, we need to trade this guy, like basically almost ran him out of town from a Twitter standpoint. I think Zardes is a healthy enough individual to where he does not check his Twitter mentions. But so, you know, quotes, he said, that's my hometown team that I grew up playing for, being the first team that gave me an opportunity to play professionally, which I'm thankful for. At times, anytime I step on the field against them, it's always something special. I'm always going to give my all for the club that I'm playing for, but I will always respect LA Galaxy. I'm a loyal person. Everything they've done for me over the years when I was part of that organization, I will always pay respect. I'm thankful for them. So thankful for the team that gave him an opportunity, but ultimately said, you're not good enough. You want to be a striker. Go play somewhere else. Goes to Columbus Crew, plays under Greg Berhalter, scores a bunch of goals. Caleb Porter comes in, immediately respects what he's done in the league, helps him score a bunch of goals, helps him win an MLS Cup. He started for a team. He was the second most important player, maybe third, depending on where Nagby was at that point. Zell Ryan obviously showed his quality in that MLS Cup final against Sounders, a 3-0 victory for them during the COVID season in 2020. And then what does he say about Columbus? It's just another game. You know, I'm focused on the opponent. How can I exploit them? I'm not focused on the emotions whatsoever. If Marcus Aurelius and if Nelson Mandela are 10 out of 10s on the stoicism scale, Giassi Zardes has to be at least an 8.5. We've spoken, Mark, both you and I, to players that have come to the Rapids as part of, you know, revenge of the distressed assets FC. And Kellen Acosta clearly still had some energy for FC Dallas. I think the next time that he still plays, certainly the two times that he's played against Colorado Rapids, he's had the same energy for the Rapids as he had for FC Dallas in the first 2 years that he was at Colorado. I still think that Mark Anthony Kay probably has some feelings around LAFC with John Thorington. I think we can now say that's probably more directed at the front office than it was at Bob Bradley, a coach who he's reunited with the Columbus Crew. So I think that's something to take into account. But, you know, we've seen that revenge energy. You know, Jonathan Lewis was still a little bit bitter about how things ended with New York Red Bulls. And so, you know, with New York City FC and with Domi Torrent after he finally got an opportunity under Patrick Vieira, I don't think Giassi Zardes has a vengeful bone in his body. I think he's going to show up on the field and everything, and this is going to be like you running into your ex, and it's be like, you know what, I'm in a new relationship. Oh, hey, there's my ex. Oh, hey, Caleb Porter's got a new girlfriend. It's Cucho Hernandez. You know what, Caleb Porter, good for you. I'm happy for you. Like, I'm just going to go be happy with my girlfriend, Robin Fraser. This is getting really weird, folks. I apologize. You know, I'm going to be happy with my new club.
Go back to the Stoic philosophy. That's a little bit less uncomfortable.
Okay, so I think that's how he's handled it. I think every single player that comes to the Rapids with a point to prove handles it in their own way. And I think Giassi is just at a new end of a new spectrum that I'm not sure, Mark, you or I were convinced exists in high level, extremely competitive, you know, alpha male athletes that can exist in this. And I think it's proven to work for Giassi's artists. I think the other ways that those players that I've mentioned, ultimately it's worked for him. Zardes has found his own path. He looks at the LA Galaxy, it's like, ah, that's the club that gave me my first opportunity. I learned so much from Robbie Keane, from Bruce Arena, from Landon Donovan. I won an MLS Cup with them. Oh, that's Columbus Crew. They gave me an opportunity after LA Galaxy were done with me. Caleb Porter helped me win MLS Cup. Now I'm here with Colorado Rapids. They're giving me an opportunity. I'm going to do everything to try and get 3 points on Saturday. I'm going to do everything to try and get this team into the playoffs, bring a second MLS Cup back to Colorado. Oh, the LA Galaxy are doing that with Chicharito Hernandez, with Dejan Jovelic. You know what? Good for them. I'm happy for them. Oh, Columbus Crew are doing their stuff with Lucas Elarán, with Cucho Hernandez. You know what? Good for them. I'm not going to give them any energy beyond that. And I think that's the healthy approach for Giassi's artists. I do think, Mark, given the familiarity and given how Columbus have been defensively, giving up 2 goals in their last game to NYCFC without Tati Castellanos, I do think the Rapids will get opportunities. I do think the Rapids will be able to score goals in this game. I do think Giassi's artists will be able to score goals in this game. I think we're seeing an improved team in terms of what they're doing on set pieces. Long Throws FC with Keegan Rosenberry. Jack Price potentially 60 minutes fit, having played the 45 that he did against Minnesota United, I think is going to make them better attacking-wise, where my main concern is this going to turn into another game that's a shootout? And unlike Minnesota, unlike New York Red Bulls, Columbus Crew are absolutely loaded with MLS All-Star Lucas Elarán and with Cucho Hernandez. If they can be remotely better defensively, if Danny Wilson can handle Cucho, whether it's Jack Price, Brian Acosta, if they can negate Lucas Elarán in any ways that other teams have not been able to, especially given this is a road game that Columbus has struggled on. Their first game at altitude, I'd have to assume since the start of the pandemic, potentially. I think the Rapids have a chance in this one. Mark, honestly, just given the quality of the opponent and everything, and given the emotions around the game, maybe for other people for Giassi's artists rather than Giassi's artists himself, I would take a 1-1 draw given where I think Columbus is going to finish in this game. I think the Rapids can win this game if they play defensively like how they have the last two games. I'm very concerned that the Rapids could be in trouble in terms of dropping points at home.
It's a good match for us. They're very even teams. There's just a lot in common. It feels very much like a drawable game, if not a winnable game. So I think the advantage goes to the team playing on the home field. So you've got to play up to that level either way. And I think that's one of the more important things to say. Again, will be occurring at a weird time, so almost certainly won't be able to watch it. But I'll probably be, and I just looked up to see what my team is playing. It's not the first week of the Israeli Premier League season this week. It's the basically our version of the Cuppity Cup Cup, but in Israel the Cuppity Cup Cup starts kind of like in the summer, so they make it they started off with the lower teams, and then the teams that are like the top of the league last year enter in the final rounds, and that doesn't happen until November, December. And so the kind of like Johnson Paint Cup, Cuppity Cup Cup is basically just a U17 to U23 cup. And so the game will certainly not be televised. If I go to a soccer bar on Saturday night, I'm almost certainly going to be watching, like Paris Saint-Germain or some Bundesliga action, but at least I'll be sculling a pint with a bunch of Israeli football fans of some kind. So as long as I can find that place, wherever it shall be.
So Mark, basically what you're telling me is that the Israeli Cup is the answer to the question. What if the MLS preseason tournament that has the Armadillo Trophy like merged with the third round FA Cup with the big teams coming in late as well? And also it's not on TV, so it's actually worse than the Open Cup from a broadcasting and a branding standpoint.
Yeah, just from a fun, for anybody still listening to our podcast at this point, who hasn't listened to the predictions and then shut it off. One of the fun things about the history of the Israeli Premier League is that it precedes the State of Israel itself. The State of Israel was founded in 1948 after a independence, after the British pulled out, kind of a similar story to Britain all over the world. And but the league was founded, I think, in like 37 or something like that. And if you go and you look at the first like 10 champions or 5 champions of the Israeli Premier League, or it was called back then the Mandatory Palestine League, it's like the first 5 champions are called the British Policemen You know, like, it's because, like, the British police had their own team. And then the next 2 years, it was the Israeli Labor Federation team. You know, it was very, like, kind of Soviet, you know, like, the tradesmen, the different laborers of the time kind of took the league. And so, you know, but if you're wondering, it doesn't, Arab teams have won the Israeli league before. There's a town in Israel called called Sakhnin. And B'nai Sakhnin is an all-Arab town, and the team is predominantly Arab, Israeli non-Arab players, aka Jewish players, on the team, and they've won the league, I think, once or twice. So, you know, it's an interesting league. It's hard to watch, though, unfortunately. You pretty much have to pay $40 a month to some random cable company in Israel in order to get it. There's no way to watch this league, so, which is why I'm really pulling for Maccabi Haifa to get into it. Listeners, you can support us in a lot of different ways. One way is by supporting our paid partners, our sponsors. Our sponsors are Icarus FC and Roughneck Scars, the purveyors of fine quality custom clothing that you can wear. You could get customized, you could do for sportswear, or you could do for some sort of party or activity. You can also buy their back catalog, all sorts of good stuff there, especially women's national team players, mostly of yore, but some who are still on the ball club. Check them out at roughneckscarves.com or IcarusFC.com. Matt, tell them how to hit us on the socials, our written materials, or how to support this fine, fantastic podcast.
Listeners, follow us collectively on the Twitter machine at @soccer_rabbi, at @LWSMattPollard, and at @Rapids96Podcast. Check out all of our written work at Pittsburgh Soccer Now, lastwordonsports.com/soccer, and holdingthehighline.substack.com. You can now go out and read my travel guide that I put out for going to attend a Rapids away day, a Rapids abroad away day, on what it would look like to go visit Antwerp and see Royal Antwerp with Sam Vines, who started 3 games. And hopefully, Mark, this article doesn't become immediately obsolete with Cole Bassett potentially getting loaned to Fortuna Sittard. But I also had some really nice things about Feyenoord. If nothing else, I try to be very visual about it. I'm currently listening to this podcast called Far Flung that tries to be very visual as an auditory podcast about travel and abroad and focusing on something really specific to kind of immerse you in there. I tried to do that in a writing form. Hopefully I did a really good job. If nothing else, I posted a bunch of pictures that I think are cool, and maybe then you can live vicariously through my trip and then live vicariously as we try to watch our two Rapids abroad as they try to compete in their respective European and club competitions as well. Sam Vines being a starter, Cole Bassett probably coming off the bench. I still contend will be a regular starter in the second half of the season after the World Cup, will prove himself to Arne Slot and will ultimately get sold to Feyenoord, but we'll see. And so you can check that out at holdingthehighline.substack.com. Subscribe to us in email form there. You can also become a paid Highliner there, $5 a month or $42 for a year. And if you do that, you can request one specific piece of content from us, an article, response to a question, or a podcast episode behind the paywall on a specific topic. If we bring further monetary value to your life and you just want to give us a single dump of cash, you can also head on over to our Patreon, patreon.com/Rapids96Podcast. Send us your questions on Twitter, like Rapids Foreign Legion and the Notorious Burgundy Beard on Twitter using the hashtag AskHDHL, or email us at Rapids96Podcast@gmail.com. Listeners, we will see you next week.
Peace.